Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 15th, 2013. Have you looked at your credit report recently? Oh, what am I thinking? Of course you have. You're a Marketplace Money listener. And that means you also know that you can get a copy of your credit report every year from each of the three credit rating agencies for free. And if getting something for free isn't enough for you, here's another reason. There's a good chance that your credit report is not entirely accurate. The Federal Trade Commission released a report this week saying more than a quarter of credit card carrying Americans have at least one potentially material error in their data. That's as many as 42 million consumers. John Alzheimer is one of our credit go-to guys. He used to work in the credit rating business for Equifax, and now he's the president of consumer education at smartcredit.com. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's your take on this new report?
The report is a little troubling. Having said that, the 42 million potential credit reports of errors, there's a little bit of a silver lining to that, meaning that the errors can be anything from a misspelled form or address, which is really meaningless in the world of credit risk assessment, to something, yes, more serious, like a collection that doesn't belong to the consumer or a late payment that didn't actually happen. So it really underscores the importance of we, the consumer, becoming way more engaged with our own credit reports to identify things that are wrong.
How should I, as a consumer, respond to this report? Should I go right out and try and check?
There's no doubt about that. You should make a beeline to annualcreditreport.com where you can actually claim your free credit report. The rules under the Fair Credit Reporting Act state that the credit reporting agencies have no liability under that particular statute until you identify something that is wrong on your credit report. And clearly, they can't correct something until you tell them that something is incorrect. The problem with that is we have done an abysmal job of checking our own credit reports.
Well, if I do find an error in my credit report, what's the dispute process like and how likely is it I'll be able to fix it?
So the dispute process starts by you communicating with the credit reporting agencies. Then they have certain obligations under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The first is they must show the item in dispute that you're challenging, which means anybody who sees it from that point forward knows that it's in question. Second, they have to identify through the furnishing party whether or not the item is correct or incorrect. And the furnishing party is almost always going to be a financial institution or a collection agency. So they're basically saying, hey, look, John filed a dispute. He says this is wrong. You let us know, is it right or wrong? And then they're going to essentially parrot back to the consumer what they heard back from the furnishing party. And then you as the consumer can either live with it, or if you're dissatisfied with the mistake, you can go directly to the source yourself and take your argument up with them.
I get the impression that as the consumer, I do not have as much weight in this process.
I would even go a little bit further and say that the consumer has no weight. The credit reporting agencies are always going to take the word of the bank or the collection agency over the word of the consumer, which is frustrating because, let's be honest, banks and collection agencies can get it wrong. And in that case, the consumer is really not only fighting against the credit reporting agencies, but they're also fighting against the bank and the collection agency, and there's just simply no way they're going to win that battle unless they do something that they probably don't want to do, which is take their battle to the courts. There's a record number of those lawsuits filed last year.
Well, any tips for our listeners as to how they might limit errors?
Yeah, you know, you should be as plugged in to the data on your credit report as you're plugged in to the charges on your credit cards. And I realize that sounds a little bit like an infatuation with a credit report. But look, 42 million of you have mistakes. And some of those mistakes are major enough to cost you a job, a loan, or a really good interest rate. You have to leverage your federal rights, and those are the free credit reports and the ability to get items corrected. Step two is take your battle to the bureaus if you think something is wrong and don't give up. And step three is if it's really costing you either money, a job, or you know, a pleasant lifestyle, then you might want to seek out a consumer advocate attorney and take your battle to the courts if you truly have been damaged and you truly have something on there that's wrong.
John Alzheimer is president of consumer education at smartcredit.com. Thank you, John, for this.
My pleasure.
If you're one of our younger listeners, you might think you don't have enough of a credit history for the rating agencies to screw up. Well, think again. If you're a student, you're already on the Credit Radar screen. Did you know lenders have found a way to integrate debit cards into student IDs? Roughly 40% of students have ID cards that double as debit cards. That keeps things simple, sure. It's one less thing to lose. But the government's worried that the agreements between colleges and card companies may not always serve students' best interests. Marketplace's Jim Burris has the story.
Chris May lives in Atlanta, and he's recently gone back to school.
I'm a history major. This is my first semester at Georgia State, and I plan on minoring in journalism.
Like many students, the 29-year-old relies on financial aid. That used to mean having to wait for a paper check or refund from the school's business office. But Chris's student ID has all that cash preloaded. It's half ID card, half Discover debit card.
I've been able to get gas with it and eat with it, so it's been pretty helpful.
Convenient? Definitely. But good for students? That's what's not clear. The question has prompted an inquiry from the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Rohit Chopra is with the CFPB.
Our school marketing agreements with banks and credit unions, are they letting students get a better deal, or are they sometimes worse off?
Chopra says colleges are required to disclose agreements they have with banks for traditional credit cards, but not so with bank cards preloaded with student aid. What is known is they can be big business. Arizona State reportedly earns $15 for each new student it links to a debit account with its preferred bank. At Ohio State, a deal with Huntington Bank is raking in $25 million over the next 15 years. Jeff Chattis is Ohio State's CFO.
When we ensure that there is no marketing of credit products, when we're asking and working with the financial institution to provide financial literacy training, and we're making their life a bit easier, so we're linking their student ID with their checking account so that they can take better control of their finances. I think when you look at all of those things together, you see that these can be structured in a very positive way.
The Huntington Bank OSU deal is funding things like classroom renovations and the school's endowment. But not all such marketing deals are good for students, says the Public Interest Research Group. In a recent report, PIRG found students often pay banking fees big and small, eating away at money set aside for tuition. A company called Higher One is one of the biggest players in the student aid refund game, holding card agreements with more than 500 campuses across the country. In August, Higher One settled with the FDIC over unfair and misleading practices. It paid restitution to 60,000 students. Higher One had no comment. Another player in the college debit card field is Wells Fargo. Erin Constantine is a senior VP with the bank.
It starts out with a checking account, maybe a savings account, but hopefully then they continue to bank with us as their financial needs change.
Constantine says ID cards linked to checking accounts also teach students financial responsibility. The National Association of College and University Business Officers, or NACUBO, agrees deals between banks and universities can be beneficial to both. The agreements often streamline the financial aid process for college business offices. Liz Clark is the group's director of congressional affairs.
But at the end of the day, we don't want to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater. We think that these programs bring a lot of benefits to students and campuses.
NACUBO has published a list of best practices to serve as a guide on how schools should handle co-branding IDs and debit cards. The organization also plans to file comments with the CFPB. Parents, students, colleges, and financial institutions have until March 18th to offer input. Based on what it hears, the CFPB will decide later this year what regulation, if any, could be warranted. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Senior citizens got a warning from the president in his State of the Union speech this week. He said big entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare may undergo some modest reforms. Proposals for cuts to services are never well received by seniors, but we do need to save some money somewhere. And that gave commentator Lori Eber an idea.
Reputable economists are predicting that baby boomers like me will bankrupt Social Security and Medicare. And millennials like my niece Lynn are none too pleased by this prospect. And would you believe some of them have even taken to calling us parasites and leeches? At the risk of offending my fellow boomers, I propose that we give up our senior discounts. It seems like the least we can do. After all, every time I get an old age price break, a Gen Yer somewhere is subsidizing me. As a 57-year-old, I qualify to purchase a host of goods and services at prices 10 to 20% lower than my under 50 friends. I've racked my lawyer brain but can't come up with any justification for this youngster tax. While this seems like a form of reverse age discrimination, it's not illegal. That's because those laws only apply to employers. These discounts have been around since the 50s and were instigated by AARP. They now pervade almost every industry, from restaurants to clothing stores to the national parks. Perhaps there was some justification for giving oldsters a break 60 years ago when Social Security benefits were stingy, people like my parents retired at 65 and expired soon thereafter. But things have changed. Today, people over 65 are less likely than younger people to live below the poverty line. Not only that, they have the highest net wealth of any age group. These discounts are now absurd. If I live to 100, I'll be entitled to a senior discount for half of my life. I, like a lot of boomers, don't need the price break. My niece Lynn, who just graduated from college and can't get a job, is more deserving. So, I'm appealing to my generation. Why not be a little magnanimous and give up your senior discounts? If nothing else, it might buy you some goodwill with your kids.
Lori Eber blogs about aging and elder care at agingbeatsthealternative.com. And now it's time for your letters. We're still fresh off of our love hangover from Valentine's Day here at Money This Week, so we've invited a couple of personal finance experts to answer your questions about money and relationships. Bob and Christy Walker have been married for 22 years, and for the last four of them, they've written the blog Frugal Fun and Financial Fitness. Bob and Christy, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Thanks, Barbara. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thanks for bringing us on the show with you.
Have you always approached money in the same way, or did you come at personal finance from completely different angles?
Oh, different angles.
I come from 18 years of banking, where I would stay up all night searching for a dime if my checkbook did not balance. Christy, on the other hand, being a single mom with two kids, had a different approach to balancing her checkbook.
What's that?
I put money in an envelope, and I knew that's what I had to spend on groceries or that's what we had to spend on fun, and there was no problem. I didn't have time to balance that checkbook. So it was quite a surprise when, after we got married and we went to go combine the account, that I had never balanced our checkbook.
I think we all know that money is one of the top things that couples fight about. But from your experience, what do couples most often get wrong about dealing with money and talking about money with each other in a relationship?
What I hear most often is when you're sitting down and you're going over what happened over the past period, if you did set up a budget and someone broke the rules, a lot of blame. Instead of starting fresh from this point forward, what caused this hurdle and what can we do in the future to make it a little bit easier to stay within these parameters?
I agree. I think, we used to have those struggles. And then coming together, setting a budget based on our values, it's easier to address it. You know, one of my favorite movies is Lion King, and we're all going to mess up. And I like what Pumbaa says is that you got to put your behind in the past. Or when Rafiki hits Simba over the head and Simba goes, "What's that for?" Because it doesn't matter. It's in the past. You just have to start off fresh. You can take a look and say, hey, our budget wasn't right. What do we do differently this time?
So don't hold a grudge. I think that applies to so many marital situations.
Yeah. And, you know, keep the past out of it. Keep focused on what you want to accomplish.
Well, it is certainly a pleasure to have you both here today to talk about some of these thorny relationship issues and also money with our listeners. Are you ready to take some calls?
Ready.
Great. We have Nina on the line with us from Bolton, Massachusetts, I see. Nina, or should I say Ninochka? What a beautiful name.
Oh, good pronunciation. Thank you.
Russian?
Yes, exactly. Well, it's the name of a Greta Garbo movie.
I know. I see from your letter that you have an issue with budgeting. What's your question for Bob and Christy?
So my husband is a self-employed contractor. And so, of course, you know, depending on the job, some months are great, some months not so great. And I don't know how to budget for, you know, that kind of sporadic income. And it just drives me crazy.
Nina, do you also work?
I do. I work part-time. We have three kids, so I work about 25 hours a week. And I'm in finance. I'm an accountant. So it more so drives me crazy because I feel like I should know how to do this. And, you know, I listen to your show, and I know I'm supposed to save for retirement, and it's overwhelming.
Oh, it's so hard, and you're juggling a lot there with kids and a job.
And we have quite a bit of credit card debt. That's the other piece of the puzzle that's frustrating.
Bob, Christy, any words of wisdom for Nina on how she and her husband can manage this fluctuating income better?
Well, Nina, you know, your situation is really interesting. It's similar to ours. A while back, I did my own consulting, so, you know, self-employed contractor here, where I made more money in 1 month than ever before, and then, you know, some months were really lean.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of things that we did, first is that we wrote down where we spent every penny, and that really showed us little leaks that we could stop and not change our lifestyle dramatically, but make changes.
Like what?
Logging where we spent money, we were spending over $600 a month eating out. So just by cooking a few meals at home, we were able to set up a college savings account for our kids.
Do I have to give up Dunkin' Donuts?
Depends on how much time you spend on the treadmill.
That's true.
And this might be a family exercise as far as what do you as a family really value? And get the kids involved, have, you know, teach them a little bit about money management. The goal for you guys is to really set up a big emergency fund where you can smooth out those months and then use the envelope system.
Yeah, I was just going to say, since your income is so variable, stop using those credit cards if at all possible. And for every month, making a payment to one of the credit cards, focus on getting that balance to zero, as well as paying into your savings account at the same time. And so eventually, that's what you're going to be tapping instead of turning to those credit cards.
Some of the other things with credit cards are really tempting to use.
Yes, they are.
One of the things that, you know, it's hard to really cut up credit cards, but what you can do is put your credit cards in a little plastic bowl, fill that bowl full of water, and stick it in your freezer. So
what?
You're literally putting
your credit cards on ice.
No.
You literally freeze your credit card.
Freeze your credit cards. They're there for an emergency. So if you really need something, instead of a cooling down period, I guess you'd have a warming up period.
Nina, you've got to speak up here.
Stick it in the microwave.
I like it.
So you think that would do it for you, huh?
I don't know if I have the discipline to do it. You know, it's funny because when you have these lean months, you just so rely on the credit cards to get by, and it creates this bad habit. And I agree. That's what I need to change, I think.
Well, I know that I don't cook fish that I have in my freezer because I have to defrost it. So.
So there you go. You wouldn't go to the store now.
How does all that sound, Nina?
It sounds great. It sounds hard, but I can try.
Very practical. Well, those envelopes really do help. I know that.
Actually, we just passed through our Valentine's week. A really good exercise for you and your husband is to sit down and do an assessment of every penny that you spend, even if it's just for 1 week, and strategize together on different options that you have. We find when we're most busy is when we were most tempted to eat out. And so starting that crock pot on Sunday night and plugging in before I left, even though I was tired, I knew a meal was already made, so we weren't going to go out to eat.
It really adds up. The other thing that I really encourage you to do is make it a whole family exercise. You know, involve the kids, get everybody involved in it, and have everybody kind of focused on the same goal and keep each other strong.
We have talked about cutting the cable cord there, and that's definitely, I think, the whole family's coming around to it.
Nina, there's a slew of suggestions. I hope some of them work out for you.
Yeah, that was terrific. Thank you so much.
And thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Care. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
More of your letters and advice coming up with Bob and Christy Walker. That's just ahead. another call. Let's see, we have Leah on the line calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Leah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, so I see you have a lot going on in your financial life. Why don't you tell us what's been happening?
My husband and I were recently married, and through that we ended up incurring some credit card debt. And I'm a graduate student, and he works full-time, and we're able to cover monthly expenses, but we recently got some money from my grandfather's estate. He passed away last year, and we're just trying to figure out the wisest way to use this inheritance. It's definitely good options right now. We can pay off the credit cards and spend the rest on opening an IRA, or we could put more into retirement savings and just keep paying off the credit cards, you know, a couple hundred dollars a month like we've been doing. So I guess, yeah, the question of how do I balance and weigh this payoff debt versus save for retirement?
Well, first, I'm sorry about your grandfather's passing.
Thank you.
And, you know, also congratulations on thinking so far ahead as a young couple towards your retirement. So, Bob and Christy, retirement versus paying off debt. How do you unravel that?
Yes. So do you guys have an emergency fund, or how are you sitting that way?
We have a couple thousand dollars in an emergency fund.
Okay. That's good. You want to be sure that you have that. Credit card debt, I would try to stop using credit cards as much as possible, go on a cash basis.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, when my grandmother passed, she gave us some money, and we put that into an account. It was into some mutual funds. And
right.
That's our rainy day fund. And when our son got married, he chose Hawaii as the place to get married. We used that for the rainy day fund. And I thank Grandma for being able to afford for us to go to Hawaii with the family.
On a whim.
Yeah, on a whim. We didn't have much notice on it.
Oh, wow.
But I would work hard at paying off the credit card debts. And the studies show now that there's empirical data that you're more likely to stick to paying off your credit cards if you start with the smallest balance, pay that off, and then once that's paid off, move what you're paying that to the next smallest balance to work on that and stick to it that way.
And Bob and Christy, are you thinking Leah is a graduate student now, but in the future, we hope and we expect she will be working and earning an income, and they can deal with the retirement issues a little later as a couple?
So it's never too early to start those IRAs. I was going to say, does your inheritance, the amount, does it cover? Can you do both, wipe out your credit card plus at least put a little bit away?
Yes. Well, that's kind of the question is, like, we have a budget. So conceivably, if we paid off the credit cards, we'd probably split what we're putting in credit cards now between, like, IRA deposits and maybe beef up that emergency fund a little bit more.
I would personally go for both. Doing a Roth IRA, even investing, this is what we tell our kids as soon as they started their part-time jobs when they were in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I want our kids to be wealthy to take care of us when we retire. So, you know, we've really encouraged that Roth IRA.
Yeah, the power of compound interest, any little bit that you can put away now, it just has huge paybacks 50 years from now. So try to get rid of as much of those credit cards as possible, but also split it to the Roth IRA.
Okay.
Yeah, I would pay off the credit cards, cut off the credit cards, put them on ice, whatever, just, you know, so that you don't use them again.
Right.
And then take that payment and open up a Roth IRA.
Leah, I hope this does it for you. You have some ideas now.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Thanks so much for calling in.
Congratulations on the wedding.
Thank you very much.
Yes, and thanks. Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's take another call. We have Spencer on the line, I see, holding on. He's calling us from Grand Blanc, Michigan. I promise I probably really messed that one up, right? Grand Blanc?
Not too
what
far
do you say?
Off. Not too far. It was Grand Blanc.
So where is Grand Blanc in the big cold state of Michigan?
It's just south of Flint and about maybe 30 minutes north of Detroit, Metro Detroit area.
Great. Now I can picture you. Well, Spencer, you fell behind in your mortgage, I see from your letter, but you talked to the bank and you persevered and they actually lowered your rate and they knocked 30 grand off your mortgage. Way to go.
I was pretty excited that we did that.
So what happened then?
Now, about 2 weeks ago, we got real unexcited when we received a 1099 in the mail for the $30,000.
I was waiting for the end of that, end of the story.
This is basically catastrophic to our current plans. We both make about, combined income, about $60,000 a year. And so to add another $30,000 to that for last year's income, we had not planned to pay the taxes on such a windfall. And the money that we do have saved, we had planned to pursue the adoption of a little girl from Russia this year.
Wow.
And so we're pretty upset right now.
So much to deal with. So let's see what kind of advice the Walkers have for you.
Yes, that'd be great.
Spencer, what a story. First of all, congratulations for digging out of debt and working with that lender to negotiate your payment plan and working it to completion. It says a lot. Is it your original mortgage? You never refinanced it. Okay, good.
So there's some good news for you. So you can breathe a little bit easier. The Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act of 2007 will actually allow you to not claim that as income, and it's up to $2 million forgiven for a married couple or a million if you're filed separately. So, you're $30,000.
That's wonderful.
Now, the thing—
I'm so happy
for you,
Spencer. Yeah. I didn't know if that was still in effect.
It is still in effect.
It got extended.
Mm-hmm. So as long as it was the amount was forgiven between 2007 and 2012, you're good there. Now, the bank sent out a 1099-C, so they have to do that because usually if a debt is forgiven, that is taxable income.
Gotcha.
So you have to do that. Now, the one thing that, it's not universal for everybody. So if I had my home for 10 years and I refinanced my home, and I took $20,000 to pay off credit cards and go on a vacation, that amount of the refinance would not be eligible for forgiveness. So it's only the amount of the principal amount that you borrowed for the purchase of your home. And if you refinanced and added on a garage or a second room, anything for major modifications in the house, that would raise up your basis to whatever that is. So does that kind of make sense to you?
Yeah. Do you feel more confident, Spencer, in adopting a child?
Our income is there for this child, and we have a wonderful support system in Grand Blanc for special needs children. She actually has Down syndrome, and so we're really excited to do that. I know financially we can support this, but in the short run, we needed money to actually fly to Russia, and being 1099'd, an additional $30,000 this year was not in our financial plan. So I'm very hopeful.
Your adoption expenses, you have more tax opportunity here. When do you foresee that the adoption will be final?
We're trying to convince them that we are ready and able to adopt. All they need to do is let us know when we can come pick her up.
Sure. For a foreign adoption, as soon as it's been finalized, you'll be able to take advantage of all those expenses that went directly toward that adoption, your travel, your lawyer fees, lodging, food.
Oh, wow.
So even if it's last year and this year added up together, once it's final, you'll be able to take it in next year for it.
In the year that it becomes final.
It becomes final, okay.
And here again, it's good to work with your tax expert. So you'll be able to add up the multiple years as long as each of those years you were married filing jointly or head of the household.
Wonderful. Well, that's great to know.
Spencer, it's a great thing you're doing, and I hope it works out for you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for all your help, guys. I'm really hopeful now that we might be able to do something.
Thanks, Spencer.
Thanks a lot for calling in. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for listener letters today. I think I'm walking away with two things. Freeze your credit cards in a ball of ice. And love and life are complicated and make for very complicated financial arrangements.
They are. It can be a fun journey. And we've been on that journey and still having fun at it.
Christy and Bob Walker, co-authors of Personal Finance, Building Your Future. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks, Barbara. We'll be right back.
week, we've been checking in on real estate markets across the U.S., and in almost every conversation, we hear about foreclosures. The foreclosure tracking company RealtyTrack says that more than 5 million homes have been foreclosed on since January 2006. Even today, the New York Fed estimates that there are nearly 500,000 lender or bank-owned properties around the country. That is a lot of real estate, and it's a big opportunity for con artists who have their own ideas about how to make a buck off of all of those vacant homes caught in limbo. From Los Angeles, Rowan Moore Garrity has the story.
When Ted Brass visits the homes he manages, he expects them to be vacant.
Wow, somebody's here. You know, put the key in the door, the key didn't work.
Brass works with foreclosures and bank-owned properties in the Inglewood area of L.A. About once a month, he finds someone living in a home he's trying to sell.
And a young man came to the door and says, yeah, they actually had a lease agreement from the person that they paid cash to. I said, this property is not for rent.
This is what's known as a foreclosure rental scam, where con artists list bank-owned properties as rentals, usually on Craigslist. They put unsuspecting tenants in the homes and collect rent until they're found out. That's exactly what happened to Vance Pritchett. He's a 27-year-old tattoo artist who recently found a great deal on Craigslist. It turned out to be the same house that Brass was trying to sell.
A house, which was a two-story house. The guy came, he gave receipts to the individuals that was paying rent.
His housemates agreed to pay cash for a break on the rent. Pritchett worked out a deal to fix up the place in exchange for a room.
We went to Home Depot, bought new locks, rake and lawn equipment, towels, toilet paper. A couple days after that, I went to school, and when I came back, I was met by Ted Brass.
Brass says that scammers prey on people who might have trouble getting a lease otherwise. They conduct their negotiations via email and disposable cell phones, and they weed out tenants who ask too many questions. These fake landlords collect first and last month's rent in cash, and then they vanish.
Ted came and told us that we had to move out and that the police was there. I packed up the same day and was out of there because there's nothing that I could do about it.
Since the housing crisis began, Brass has hired inspectors to check in on the properties he manages.
So I do weekly inspections to these different properties to make sure that nobody has actually moved in.
That's Vance Pritchett Sr. He came to help his son move out of Ted Brass's property. Brass was impressed with the way that Pritchett handled a tense situation, and he offered him a job as a home inspector. I drive with Pritchett Sr. from foreclosure to foreclosure in a part of Inglewood where nearly 8% of homes are vacant.
So we come in to a vacant house and it echoes.
Most of the homes that Pritchett inspects have for sale signs out front. Many are owned by the mortgage lender, Freddie Mac. He takes pictures, checks the lights and water, and locks up again. Rob Hagberg is Associate Director of Fraud Investigations at Freddie Mac. He describes foreclosure rental scams as a crime of opportunity.
Florida, Nevada, California, it would seem that any area of the country where there's a large inventory of foreclosed properties is going to be vulnerable.
In Los Angeles, these crimes have been on the rise. But Hagberg says that this type of fraud often goes unreported. Wait a minute, unreported?
Calling law enforcement is a double-edged sword.
Adam O'Neill is a real estate investor who buys bank-owned homes throughout Los Angeles.
What often happens is law enforcement will ask for a lease, and they'll see the lease, and they will determine then that it is a civil matter.
If police aren't confident the lease is fake, and usually they aren't, they may decline to get involved.
In this situation, there's a couple things we can do. We can try to evict them or go through a legal process, which is costly and time-consuming. Or you negotiate a cash for keys situation.
Cash for keys is another type of foreclosure rental scam. Con artists occupy a house just as it sells and demand several thousand dollars from the new owners before agreeing to move out. O'Neill says that he and other investors almost always decide to pay up.
You make a business decision even though you know it's really criminal activity.
O'Neill and his partners buy and remodel up to 20 distressed homes at once. They do whatever they can to avoid scams. They board up homes within hours of buying them, install alarm systems, and even pay their own employees to live in them, moving from house to house to house. O'Neill says new homeowners should try to secure their homes or move in as soon as possible. As for renters, Freddie Mac's Rob Hagberg says,
if it looks too good to be true, it just might be.
Some basic tips? Google a property's address to see if it's for sale. don't pay cash, and ask a lot of questions. In Los Angeles, I'm Rowan Moore-Garrity for Marketplace.
Well, you can bet that there were plenty of foreclosure scams going on in Las Vegas in the day. It used to be called the foreclosure capital of the nation. But the city's experiencing a turnaround of sorts. Last month, it dropped to number 6 on RealtyTrack's list of cities burdened by foreclosures. So what's behind the shifting market in Sin City? For this week's Housing Market Check-In, we turn now to Colleen Kelly. She's the president-elect of the Nevada Association of Realtors. She's been selling real estate in Las Vegas for more than 2 decades. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give us a snapshot of the Las Vegas real estate scene?
We're suffering from a shortage of inventory. Very much a seller's market at this point. Buyers are making multiple offers on properties. We have a lot of foreign investors coming in.
Well, what's the typical house going for, and what do you get for that? What does it look like?
Our median income price here is about $150,000. And that's, you know, you're looking at probably a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage. Houses, though, you know, are in various states of disrepair. Some of them are good. Some of them have been sitting for long periods of time. So you may have leaks, and they may have been vandalized, where air conditioning units and different things have been taken from the property. So each property is unique unto itself.
So how are people feeling there?
Cautious optimism. More than half of our market is short sales. So, you know, that's a good thing for sellers as opposed to being foreclosed on. So there is some optimism, certainly, within the marketplace because our prices have risen here almost 27% in a year.
So what's the significance of the fact that half of the home sales are short sales?
That's a sign of improvement. Certainly the banks are willing to do those type of sales, so that's certainly moving inventory through the system and clearing it out.
And what does it mean for home buyers?
Short sales are not short, per se.
You mean they take a long time? Yeah,
they take a long time.
They're complicated, I know.
And we have a large portion of the market are investor purchases, because more than half of our market is cash sales.
Well, you've seen such dramatic swings in the market, perhaps more so than anywhere in the nation. And I hear the tired warrior in your voice. Is that what it feels like now to be a realtor in Las Vegas, that you've kind of seen it all?
Well, having been in the business for as long as I have, I've certainly seen market changes and ups and downs. But this particularly was the perfect storm. I mean, with the housing market declining so quickly and unemployment going up and construction stopping in midstream and financing, it was everything all at one time. So certainly those that have remained in the market have been beaten up a few times.
Did you ever think about changing careers?
No.
Never?
No, this is, you know, something that it's a good feeling to get first-time homebuyers and people who didn't think they could have a piece of that American dream. It's nice to put those people into a home.
What's the most difficult situation you faced selling a home in these past few years?
It's difficult to see people who have been in their homes and now have lost them. I had one of my agents had invested in a number of homes during the boom and lost all of them, including the home that she was living in. So there's a lot of sad stories here in the Las Vegas Valley.
What do you see in the future for Las Vegas?
Statistics were 1 out of every 4 houses were underwater, but 2011 was the best sales year that we ever had, and last year was the 3rd highest sales year. So hopefully in a short period of time, we'll be able to return to a normal market.
Colleen Kelly is president-elect of the Nevada Association of Realtors, also past president of the Greater Las Vegas Association of Realtors. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear how the housing market's doing where you live. Tell us at marketplace.org. Today's show, appropriately enough, with a sign-off, specifically how you sign your business emails. Some people keep it simple. Name, contact info, short and sweet. And then there are the more expressive types, who include favorite URLs, quirky quotes, and emoticons. Not surprisingly, women are perhaps the most communicative bunch when it comes to their digital Hancocks. More and more women are signing their emails, even at the office, with hugs and kisses, or XO. Writers Rachel Simmons and Jessica Bennett say that this speaks volumes about women's issues in the workplace. They've written an article about it in this month's issue of The Atlantic. Jessica, Rachel, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Well, my favorite example from your article is about Diane Sawyer's newsroom, that staffers say that the anchor uses XO so frequently that its omission can spark panic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much a sign of, like, things are okay between us. And I think when you get habituated to XO, and particularly if you're attentive to relationships, which I think a lot of women are, when you notice suddenly there is no X, no O, wait a minute, is there a secret message embedded in that omission?
And getting it doesn't actually mean that I want to kiss or hug somebody. It's just made its way into email communication more and more and more as we're unable to kind of signify tone in a lot of ways in our writing. And, you know, now I work as an editor, and it is amazing the number of female strangers who will pitch me story ideas and sign with an XO in a professional setting.
Do you think it's a function of this fact that we don't have much room to express our personalities in business emails? And that signature really has become that real estate.
I think people agonize over this to some extent. You don't want to seem too stiff or stuffy or serious. And a lot of people want to be kind of casual and fun, but you don't want to be too casual.
I mean, we have so little time these days to type much of anything. And so XO also just becomes this very quick abbreviation that says, you know, everything's okay, or I still care about you, or whatever it is that we don't have time to actually write down in words in our crazy kind of lives.
We both raise an interesting gender issue, that some women in the workplace feel they have to apologize for being direct or authoritative. There's a lot of research on this. Rachel, how does the XO role play into that corner of workplace psychology?
Well, I think the XO cuts the edge off the abruptness that so many women have learned to curtail. As much as I in my life might be working with young women to educate them to be more assertive, there's no question that assertiveness gets you punished often. And so women have had to adapt to that. XO is a very ingenious adaptation to that pressure not to be too bossy, too assertive. I've also noticed exclamation points being kind of a cheerful top-off to asking someone to do something. It's like, thanks a lot, exclamation point. That sounds so much more congenial, friendly, than just a hard and unfriendly period.
Right. And, you know, I find myself doing this in my own emails. Sometimes it almost feels like a period is too harsh and serious.
This is starting to feel a little bit like a grammar confessional. I also often use ellipses as a way not to seem too demanding. Like, it would be great if you could do it, dot, 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 as opposed to period.
I was also thinking that maybe the ubiquity of hugs and kisses in email has to do with the increasing blurring of public and private in our lives. You know, people market themselves now so much on Facebook and Twitter, and you have so many people working from home, and you're using your networks of friends to try to get jobs.
I think you're right. You're best friends with all 10,000 of your Twitter followers so much that you can, you know, sign your tweet with an X.
To some extent, the XO phenomenon is a nod to the importance of networking. I think people increasingly understand in an information economy that relationships matter a lot. And everyone can't be our friend, though in the age of Facebook, it certainly feels that way.
Well, what kind of email signatures make you guys roll your eyes?
Uh-oh. Is this a private conversation?
Oh, yes, of course. No one's listening.
Too many X's and O's is ridiculous. You know, I like a good cheers. Sincerely seems a little formal. Best, I use that a lot. What else, Rachel?
I think that the goal is to find something that speaks to your feelings for the person without appearing disingenuous or overdoing it. Signatures are a kind of language we need to learn, and they involve a particular amount of skill. And having, you know, XO for anybody really cheapens it, but yeah, it can definitely leave you feeling annoyed.
Jessica Bennett is the executive editor of Tumblr. Rachel Simmons is the author of several books, including The Curse of the Good Girl. Their article, Kisses and Hugs in the Office, appears in this month's issue of The Atlantic. Rachel, Jessica, cheers to both of you.
Thank you.
XO.
Well, come to think of it, how do you sign your emails?
Sometimes if it's girlfriends, I'll put like XOXO or like...
If you're trying to not aggravate somebody, like if you're canceling an appointment or something, it's like very best wishes, my very best, something like that.
If it's someone I don't know that well, but I'm friendly with, or acquaintances, and it's informal, I put cheers. I don't know where I got that from. Like,
and one thing I always grapple with is the exclamation point. I think a lot of people use... They sign off thanks and exclamation point, and it's a very different sign off than thanks, comma. Yeah.
Kind regards or warmest regards or something like that, but usually short.
Oh, yeah, sometimes we fake formality and like just inner office emails where you're like over formal, like very best wishes for the current year or something like that.
When I was an undergraduate, I put in song lyrics.
I don't use animation or crazy colors or... quote
Tori Amos and Fiona Apple and Rufus Wainwright songs.
I don't think they're looking at my email about grabbing lunch in order to get words of wisdom from a philosopher or anything like that.
And that was Raji Kalera, Cooper Rose, Heather Hartnett, Sam Johnson, Austin Eyre, Jesse Zelay, and Daniel Kramer. From XO to yours truly, find out what your email sign-off says about you at marketplace.org. All best, and we sincerely appreciate that you listened to Marketplace Money this week. You can tell us what you think of the show at marketplace.org. By the way, are you on Facebook? We're on Facebook, too. Why aren't we friends? Let's get on that. And you can get on our Twitter feed at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, online funerals are gaining popularity, but not everyone is on board with a virtual memorial service.
My family, I think they thought it might have been intrusive. They originally did not want to do it, and I did. I thought it was a good idea. And we got wonderful responses from people who saw it live. Even one of my dad's elderly friends figured out how to do it and watched it live.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Paranava, and Gina Delvec. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.